It is the title given to the state prosecutor presenting a case against an individual in a criminal trial. Goldstone was presumably referring to the office of the prosecutor general, the head of Russia's judiciary. Rona appears to be a reference to Rona Graf, Trump's longtime assistant. Very high level, ultra-sensitive, too sensitive for Rona. Official documents incriminate Hillary. Part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump. Don Jr. was intrigued. 17 minutes later, he responded. He was on the road and wanted to speak to Amin first, but he added, "If it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer. Could we do a call first thing next week when I am back?" Rather than wait until the next week, however, suddenly things went into overdrive. In the midst of a spectacularly frenetic presidential campaign, three key people in the campaign, the newly appointed campaign manager, Paul Manafort, son-in-law and crown prince, Jared Kushner, and Don Jr., wiped their schedules clean and set up a mysterious meeting with an unnamed Russian government lawyer. And so, they got together at 4 p.m. on Thursday, June 9th, in Don Jr.'s 25th floor Trump Tower office. Don had been told the Russians would bring two people to the meeting, but instead there were five. Leading the way was Natalia V. Veselnitskaya, a Russian lawyer who was in New York representing Denis Katsev's Cyprus-based Prevazon Holdings. Prevazon was being prosecuted by United States Attorney Preet Bharara for allegedly laundering $230 million via the tax fraud that Sergei Magnitsky had uncovered. Like other Russian companies, Prevazon had made a point of hiring lawyers who had lots of clout. Earlier, it had been represented by former FBI director Louis Free. Another Prevazon attorney, Scott Balber, also had represented Donald Trump in 2013, when Trump sued comedian Bill Maher because the comedian failed to honor a promise to pay $5 million if Trump could prove he wasn't the spawn of his mother having sex with an orangutan. As for Sergei Magnitsky, his death in 2009 had led Congress to pass the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act, which became emblematic of the intensely volatile relations between the Obama administration and Putin. The bipartisan bill, which passed the Senate by an overwhelming 92-4 margin, was intended to punish Russians who were allegedly responsible for the death of Sergei Magnitsky by prohibiting them from entering the United States and its banking system, and by allowing American officials to seize assets belonging to Russians who had been implicated in human rights cases. By sanctioning individuals close to Putin, the Obama administration was saying, in effect, that Russia was a mafia state, and that it made sense not to strike at the Russian people with punishing economic measures, but instead to target the select group of individuals, mobsters, oligarchs, public officials, responsible, and to penalize them. It was a weapon that struck at the core of the pact Putin had with his oligarchs. After all, if he could no longer provide Krisha, if Putin could no longer protect his oligarchs, how much longer would they pay fealty to him? Bill Browder, who was Magnitsky's boss and who had crusaded to get the eponymous bill passed by Congress, explained the calculus to the American interest. "Putin allows people to get rich off the proceeds of government service," Browder said, "and then he asks them to do services he's interested in for the state. He asks his subordinates to do very terrible things, to torture people, to kill people, to kidnap people, in order for the government to seize people's properties. And in return, he offers them impunity. If all of a sudden he can't promise them foreign impunity, that messes up everything for him." In response to the Magnitsky Act, Russia passed the Dima Yakovlev Bill, sometimes known as the Anti-Magnitsky Law, part of which bans citizens of the United States from adopting Russian children, thereby reframing the Magnitsky conflict issue as a human rights issue in which the United States was undermining the welfare of abandoned Russian orphans. To promote the cause, Veselnitskaya founded the Human Rights Accountability Global Initiative Foundation in Washington to lobby for restoring American adoption of Russian children. Which sounded like a cause no one could disagree with, but since the Kremlin promised to rescind the anti-Magnitsky law if the sanctions were lifted, the word adoption had become a code word that really meant lifting sanctions. This was the genius of K Street lobbying that Paul Manafort had taught the Russians. In fact, they were lobbying to provide relief to oligarchs and gangsters who had allegedly been behind the $230 million tax scam and who tortured and killed Sergei Magnitsky. But they could promote their cause under the banner of human rights with pictures of cute little orphans who were in desperate need of an American home. Of the people in the room, Don Jr. was most interested in the so-called highly sensitive information referred to in the Goldstone emails that would supposedly incriminate Hillary. Before the meeting, Veselnitskaya had sent a 4-page memo to the Trump team asserting that the Ziff brothers, a trio of billionaire Democratic donors, had allegedly evaded paying U.S. taxes on Russian investments. Ziff Brothers Investments, LLC, has made donations to both Republicans and Democrats since the 2012 election cycle, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. It gave between $50,000 and $100,000 to the Clinton Global Initiative and made modest donations to the presidential campaigns of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. The Ziffs had been donors to Obama, and it was possible they were donors to Hillary Clinton as well. That's what Don Jr. was interested in, if it could be tied to Hillary. But instead, Veselnitskaya launched into a spiel about Bill Browder and Hermitage Capital Management, arguing that Browder was the real architect of a massive tax fraud scheme against the Russian state, which was of little interest to Don Jr. Then she asked whether a Trump presidency would lift the Magnitsky sanctions. Looking ahead, if we come to power, we can return to this issue and think what to do about it, Don Jr. said, as she recalled. Finally, Don Jr. asked her the crucial question on his mind. This money the Ziffs got from Russia, do you have any financial documents showing that this money went to Clinton's campaign? He asked, according to Veselnitskaya. The answer, alas, was no. And with that, the air suddenly went out of the room. Team Trump wanted dirt on Hillary, but the Russians hadn't delivered. Don Jr. thought it was a complete waste of time. Jared Kushner had stood by vaguely throughout. He was so bored, he texted his assistant. Can you please call me on my cell? Need excuse to get out of meeting. But if the meeting was a waste of time for the Americans, it was a triumph for the Russians. Trump Jr. may have been upset that the Russians had not come through with the promised incriminating evidence about Hillary. But to the Russians, this was not about a single transaction. Instead, it was about structuring an ongoing relationship. Former CIA acting director Michael Morell described the email exchange between Rob Goldstone and the Trumps as huge, given that it shows that a senior member of the Trump team knew in early summer of 2016 that the Russians were working on behalf of Trump. In the midst of an insanely hectic campaign, three key members of Donald Trump's inner circle had cleared the decks for Veselnitskaya and her entourage, seemingly without even really understanding what the agenda was, or for that matter, who they were really meeting with. For her part, Veselnitskaya later insisted that in meeting with the Trump team, she was in no way working for the Russian government. But there was more to the story than she let on. First, far from being just a private lawyer, since 2013, Veselnitskaya has also been an informant for Yuri Chaika, the prosecutor general of Russia, who is close to Agalarov and has been a strong Putin loyalist. Chaika, quite likely, is the man Rob Goldstone meant when he referred to the Crown Prosecutor. Moreover, according to the New York Times, emails obtained and released by Dossier, an organization founded by Mikhail B. Khodorkovsky, the oligarch who was stripped of his holdings, put in jail, and then exiled from Russia, indicate that Veselnitskaya worked closely with a senior prosecutor on Chaika's staff to write the Russian government response to a U.S. Justice Department request in 2014 for help with its civil fraud case against Prevezon and its owner, Denis Katsev. In other words, she was deeply connected within the Kremlin, and the case she made reflected its talking points. Much as Don Jr. evinced a lack of interest in her sanctions presentation, it may well have met a more welcome reception by another member of the Trump team. While Don was miffed at the unfulfilled promise of dirt on Hillary, Paul Manafort was quietly taking notes on his cell phone. In full, they read, Bill Browder, offshore, Cyprus, 133 million shares, companies, not invest, loan, value in Cyprus as inter, Elisi, active sponsors of RNC, Browder hired Joanna Glover, tied into Cheney, Russian adoption by American families. As noted by the Washington Post, Joanna Glover is likely a reference to Juliana Glover, who worked with Browder in promoting the Magnitsky Act and also worked for Dick Cheney at one time. These, then, were Veselnitskaya's talking points, crafted from a memo she'd written with the staff of the Russian Prosecutor General, and Donald Trump Jr.'s indifference aside, Manafort knew this was no joke. There was money on the table. All of this went back to Putin. This was the Kremlin speaking, and given the content of the meeting, it seemed to be taking them seriously. Then there was the fact that, in addition to Goldstone and an unnamed translator, Veselnitskaya had brought along two additional men. Who were they? One was Rinat Akhmetishin, a Soviet-born American citizen from Tatarstan in his early 50s, who had become that truly Washington creature, a self-proclaimed K Street lobbyist, spending other people's money to achieve other people's goals, as he put it. Akhmetishin happened to be earning his money by lobbying to get rid of the Magnitsky Act, and by his account, he ended up at Trump Tower that day by sheer happenstance. As the Financial Times reported it, Akhmetishin says he had taken the train from D.C. to New York that day in order to see a Russian play that evening when Veselnitskaya called. That's why, he claims, he was dressed so casually. Regardless of his wearing jeans and a T-shirt instead of his usual suit, Akhmetishin, with his long history of ties to Russian intelligence, won instant entree to the inner sanctum of the Trump campaign. When the Magnitsky Act was being debated on Capitol Hill, according to two observers, Akhmetishin could be seen walking with former Congressman Ron Dellums, whom he had recruited, and Paul Behrens, senior aide to Dana Rohrabacher, a Republican congressman from California, to meet with top Democrats on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel and Gregory Meeks. Widely known as Putin's favorite congressman, Rohrabacher traveled to Moscow on an official congressional trip in April 2016, Politico reported, and met privately with Vladimir Yakunin, a Putin confidant who was sanctioned in 2014 after the Russians invaded Ukraine. Yakunin has been close to Putin for more than two decades, dating to the early 90s, when he helped Putin set up the Ozera co-op dachas on the shore of Lake Komsomolskaya. Kyle Parker, a House Foreign Affairs Committee staffer who was a driving force behind the Magnitsky Act, noticed Akhmetishin making the rounds of Congress and immediately sent out an email blast to his colleagues, alerting them that Akhmetishin used to spy for the Soviets and specialized in active measures campaigns, according to an email reviewed by Politico. For his part, Akhmetishin insists he is not a spy, although he makes it clear he is more than familiar with that world. Others, however, are not so sure. He is a former GRU person for sure, an attorney who worked with Ahmed Tishan, told The Guardian. Then he added, he once said, there is no such thing as former. If Ahmed Tishan's appearance didn't raise questions, there was the final member of Veselnitskaya's group. She had brought with her Irakli Kaveladze, who had worked for the Agalarovs for years and had been in Vegas with Trump and the Agalarovs in 2013. A longtime Agalarov loyalist, Kaveladze was there to monitor the situation on behalf of his patron, but he was also a man who had moved more than $1 billion through 2,000 U.S. corporations he created, a man whom former Democratic Senator Carl Levin called a poster child of money laundering. Kaveladze's attorney's explanation for his client's presence was that he was attending the meeting as a translator, but that made no sense. Veselnitskaya already had arranged for an unnamed professional translator. Between Kaveladze and Ahmed Tishan, with his past in military intelligence, Veselnitskaya with her ties to Chaika, and the content of the meeting, it's hard to believe the Russians were there in their stated role as lobbyists. As former acting director of the CIA, John McLaughlin, put it to the Cipher Brief, it looks to me like an elaborate operation carried out through intermediaries to probe the receptivity of the Trump campaign to assistance from the Russian government during the campaign. It is not unusual for it to be carried out through such a long chain of intermediaries, because the tradecraft objective here is to separate the original ambition as far as possible from the ultimate result, so it becomes very hard to trace back, as it is in this case, exactly what happened and who did what, McLaughlin said. And what did the Russians learn? They learned that Jared, distracted as he was, didn't seem to mind participating in such dirty tricks. They had seen that Don Jr. was eager to play ball, writing back, I love it. And how security conscious was the scion of the future president? Don Jr. waited a mere 17 minutes before responding to Goldstone. Then he wrote back, apparently oblivious to the fact that he was creating a paper trail directly between himself and the Russians. All the various threads were coming together. The Russians had, in effect, activated a channel from the Trumps through the Agalarovs to the Kremlin, from Don Jr. to Amin to Amin's father to Putin, with Rob Goldstone forwarding messages as necessary. Manafort was still in touch with Kalimnik and was offering private briefings to Deripaska. Even though Bayrock was no longer operational, its presence had opened ongoing relations to the Kremlin through Chabad and through Felix Sater, who had continued to develop Russian contacts and go to Moscow on behalf of Trump. Moreover, according to a report in Christopher Steele's dossier, a Kremlin insider with direct access to the leadership confirmed that a key role in the secret Trump campaign/Kremlin relationship was being played by the Republican candidate's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. The Republican National Convention was getting underway in Cleveland in July. Never before had Russia had someone in its grasp who was so deeply compromised as Trump, with his vast array of ties to the Russian mafia and oligarchs. Never before had Russia had someone in its grasp who was so close to power as Donald Trump, the presumptive presidential nominee of the Republican Party. Something big was bound to happen. Chapter 20. Endgame. On June 15th, 2016, 6 days after the Trump Tower meeting, Republican leaders in the House of Representatives got together to discuss the situation in Ukraine. Two of them, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, a representative from Wisconsin, and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy from California, had just met the new Ukrainian Prime Minister, Volodymyr Groysman, who had come into power saying he was committed to stamping out corruption and strengthening ties to the European Union. Ryan seemed to like Groysman. This guy's a pretty good guy, he said, according to a transcript of the conversation published by the Washington Post. This guy's like the anti-corruption guy, and he's passing all these anti-corruption laws. The conversation piqued the interest of Representative Kathy Rogers, the Republican conference chairman from Washington. "How are things going in Ukraine?" she asked. "Well, the Russians are bombing them 30 to 40 shells a day," Ryan said. "Crimea is gone, and they're trying to clean up their government to show that they want to be Western. He has this really interesting riff about what Russia is doing to us. Financing our populists, financing people in our governments to undo our governments, you know, messing with our oil and gas energy. All the things Russia does to basically blow up our country, they're going to roll right through us and go to the Baltics and everyone else." "Yes," said Rogers. She added that she had been astounded by the sophistication of Russian propaganda. "This isn't just about Ukraine," said Ryan. "It's a propaganda war," said Rogers. "Maniacal." "Yes," said Rogers. "And guess who's the only one taking a strong stand up against it," said Ryan. "We are." "What?" Rogers was agog. She didn't buy it for a second. "We're not. We're not. But we're not." All the while, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy had been listening and decided to join in. The second-ranking Republican after Ryan, McCarthy had a nasty habit of blurting out inconvenient truths every once in a while. In 2015, on Fox News, no less, McCarthy had said that a principal reason behind the costly and interminable congressional investigations into the Benghazi tragedy had been to drive down Hillary Clinton's poll numbers. "Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right?" he said. "But we put together a Benghazi special committee, a select committee. What are her numbers today? Her numbers are dropping." McCarthy had appalled fellow Republicans because he had just corroborated Democratic allegations that the Benghazi probe was not about getting to the bottom of a real scandal, so much as turning Congress's investigative powers into a political weapon against Hillary. This time, the majority leader had an opportunity to make an even bigger gaffe. The day before, a hacker using the name Guccifer 2.0 had gone public in claiming credit for breaking into the Democratic National Committee's computers, and a cybersecurity firm called CrowdStrike had attributed the operation to Russian intelligence. Now came McCarthy's eureka moment. "I'll guarantee you that's what it is," he said. Unintelligible. "The Russians hacked the DNC and got the op research that they had on Trump." "And delivered it to who?" asks Ryan. Unintelligible. "There's two people. I think Putin pays Rohrabacher and Trump." Laughter. "Swear to God." Ryan couldn't believe what he was hearing. Kevin McCarthy, the second most powerful Republican in the House, had said Trump and Rohrabacher were on the Kremlin payroll. How else to explain Russia's generosity to the Republicans when it came to Democratic emails? As Speaker of the House, Ryan tried to gain control. He could not allow this to become public. "This is an off-the-record," laughter. "No leaks," laughter. "All right? This is how we know we are a real family here. What's said in the family stays in the family." When asked to comment on the exchange, Brendan Buck, a spokesman for Ryan, told the Washington Post that it never happened. Matt Sparks, a spokesman for McCarthy, said, "The idea that McCarthy would assert this is absurd and false." After being told that there was a recording, Sparks characterized the conversation as a failed attempt at humor. 8 days later, on June 23rd, the United Kingdom became an example of what Ryan had called Russia's attempts to basically blow up a country. When Britain dealt an extraordinary and unexpected blow to the European Union by severing its most vital connection to Europe, to the astonishment of hundreds of millions of people all over the world, 51.9% of the British electorate voted to leave the European Union. And what was Russia's role? At the time, few people were aware of the extent of Russia's interference. Only later, in 2018, did a minority report from the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee conclude that the Russian government has sought to influence democracy in the United Kingdom through disinformation, cyber hacking, and corruption. The Kremlin has long aimed to undermine European integration and the EU, in addition to its aims to sow confusion and undermine confidence in democratic processes themselves, making Brexit a potentially appealing target, it added. According to a research team from the University of California at Berkeley and Swansea University in Wales, Russia had assembled at least 150,000 Twitter accounts to promote Brexit. A report by Britain's National Bureau of Economic Research later showed that automated tweeting played a small but potentially decisive role that was possibly large enough to affect the outcomes in the 2016 Brexit vote by adding 1.76 percentage points to the pro-leave vote share. The bottom line, Russian interference may have made the difference. In early July, Republicans began gathering in Cleveland, Ohio, prior to the Republican National Convention to hammer out their platform. The party elders had had little input from the presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, on most issues, with the striking exception of American policy with regard to Ukraine. Throughout the campaign, Trump had been less than supportive of Ukraine in its ongoing battle with Russia. In August 2015, when asked by NBC's Chuck Todd on Meet the Press what he thought about Ukraine's joining NATO, "I wouldn't care," he replied. He also said that Ukraine was really a problem that affects Europe a lot more than it affects us. Coupled with his prediction to Bill O'Reilly that "I would have a great relationship with Putin," Trump's remarks led anti-Russia activists in Ukraine to call Trump a Kremlin agent. That Trump's sentiments also were directly at odds with most Republicans became readily apparent when platform committee member Diana Denman, a longtime GOP activist from Texas, called for a plank saying the U.S. would provide lethal defensive weapons to Ukraine for its battle with Russian separatists. Denman did not expect a battle. Her proposal was very much in line with age-old GOP policies. But before long, two men who said they were part of the Trump campaign came over to her, read the language she wanted to insert, and said it needed to be reviewed. One of the men was J.D. Gordon, a 48-year-old former Pentagon spokesman who was now a foreign policy advisor on the Trump campaign. He introduced himself to Denman and said he had phoned New York about the Ukraine plank. When she asked Gordon whom he had spoken to, he told her he had discussed it with Trump. Gordon has called Denman's account inaccurate. Gordon said this is the language that Donald Trump himself wanted and advocated for back in March at a meeting at the unfinished Trump Hotel here in Washington, D.C., CNN's Jim Acosta reported. J.D. Gordon says then-candidate Trump said he didn't want to, quote, go to World War III over Ukraine. And so, as J.D. Gordon says, at the Republican convention in Cleveland, he advocated for language in that Republican Party platform that reflected then-candidate Trump's comments. In the end, Gordon won, and the language was changed from calling on the U.S. to provide Ukraine lethal defensive weapons to the phrase appropriate assistance. Ohio Senator Rob Portman described the radical change in policy as deeply troubling, and even Charlie Black, a veteran Washington political operative who was once a partner of Manafort's, said the new position in the platform doesn't have much support from Republicans. Which, of course, was something of an understatement. The direction indicated by the new plank was a far-reaching and profound departure from everything the Republican Party had stood for. But Trump wasn't the only person Gordon spoke to who would have approved of the change. During the convention, Gordon also had two brief encounters with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, who had quietly started to pop up in secret meetings repeatedly with Trump operatives. It's not clear what role Kislyak might have played in aiding the Trump campaign, but the Kremlin was always eager to know the latest on Trump's positions regarding sanctions and Ukraine. Just 2 months earlier, in April, Hope Hicks, a Trump spokesperson, had said incorrectly that a meeting with Kislyak in Washington never happened. There was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign, Hicks told the AP. Yet on April 27th, Trump gave a major foreign policy speech sponsored by the Center for the National Interest at Washington's Mayflower Hotel, in which he called for better relations with Moscow. I believe an easing of tensions and improved relations with Russia from a position of strength only is possible. Absolutely possible, Trump said. That Trump chose the Center for the National Interest as the forum to make his remarks was in itself of interest, in that Putin had referred to its director, former Nixon aide Dmitry Symes, as his American friend and colleague in 2013, and Symes had pledged his full support for Putin's aggressive stance on Syria. As it happened, however, Ambassador Kislyak was seated in the front row, and before the event there was a private meeting with him and Trump, Jeff Sessions, then the Republican senator from Alabama, who had joined the Trump team in February, and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Sessions denied being at any such meetings. This was not a question of chance contacts occurring with Russian officials at embassy soirees in the Washington social whirl. Throughout the operation, Trump surrogates repeatedly and deliberately reached out to Russian officials and otherwise made clear their knowledge of ongoing Russian operations to attack Clinton's campaign. Current and former U.S. officials familiar with the exchanges told Reuters that Michael Flynn and other Trump advisors made at least 18 calls and emails to Kremlin operatives during the last 7 months of the 2016 presidential campaign. Even before he attended the December 2015 dinner in Moscow with Putin, and before Guccifer 2.0 took credit for the DNC hacking in 2016, General Flynn and his son had met secretly with Kislyak at the ambassador's residence in Washington. And Flynn's correspondence strongly suggested that he was very much in the loop with regard to Russia's hacking operation. In mid-July 2016, he emailed an unnamed Trump communications advisor, "There are a number of things happening and will happen this election via cyber operations by both hacktivists, nation states, and the DNC." In the wake of the Trump Tower meeting in June and the weakened Ukraine plank, Russian support came pouring in the form of money, strategic advice, and newly forged alliances. Simon Kukis, a Russian-born American citizen who had replaced Putin foe Mikhail Khodorkovsky as head of Yukos, gave a total of $283,283 to various Trump entities, including a joint fundraising committee called Trump Victory, whose beneficiaries included the Trump campaign, the RNC, and several state-level committees. At about the same time, even before his firm had finalized a contract with the Trump campaign, Cambridge Analytica CEO Alexander Nix reached out to Julian Assange and asked him to share the DNC emails so CA could help disseminate them. On July 14th, George Papadopoulos sent an email to a contact with Kremlin ties asserting that top Trump officials had agreed to a pre-election meeting with representatives of Putin in the UK that would include the campaign's national chairman and maybe one other foreign policy advisor. "It has been approved by our side," Papadopoulos wrote in the email. 4 days later, the Heritage Foundation staged a seminar which Jeff Sessions attended and took the opportunity to speak with Kislyak. A number of Sessions's conversations with the ambassador were intercepted by U.S. spy agencies, which characterized them as substantive discussions on U.S.-Russia relations in a Trump administration and Trump's positions on various issues concerning Russia. During the Republican National Convention, Kislyak had also met with Carter Page. Then on July 22nd, 3 days before the Democratic National Convention was to open in Philadelphia, WikiLeaks released nearly 20,000 hacked emails from the DNC. Though they revealed nothing illegal, the emails showed that party officials, who are meant to remain neutral, favored Hillary Clinton and had discussed ways to undermine Bernie Sanders, leading to the resignation of DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Typical of much of the mainstream press, the New York Times mentioned allegations that Russian hackers had penetrated the DNC computer system, but focused on the internal bickering within the Democratic Party. That was more important than the fact that a hostile foreign power was assaulting America's electoral system. And so, one of the most unusual political campaigns in American history was underway, with Trump putting forth a right-wing, nativist, protectionist, anti-immigrant populism, all under the umbrella of Making America Great Again. Again and again throughout the campaign, contrary to every expectation, Trump's transgressions worked to his advantage, not his disadvantage. Thanks to his showmanship, Trump benefited enormously from getting more free media attention than any other candidate. Indeed, according to analysis from SMG Delta, a firm that tracks television advertising, from the beginning of his campaign through February 2016, still early in the campaign cycle, it was estimated that Trump received nearly $2 billion in free media, twice what Clinton got. Mixing the aesthetics of professional wrestling and reality TV, he threw red meat to his base. It was good, not bad, to demean Mexicans as rapists, to say women who have abortions should serve time in jail, to deride Senator John McCain, a Vietnam War hero who was tortured and spent 6 years as a POW because he had been captured, to ban immigrants solely on the basis of their Muslim religion, even to urge a supporter to knock the crap out of them, anti-Trump protesters. "I promise you, I will pay the legal fees," Trump added. And the crowds loved it. Even then, Trump upped the ante. When she was Secretary of State, Clinton had used a private email address and server rather than State Department servers, thereby raising concerns about security and the preservation of emails and leading to an FBI probe. That had ended on July 5th, with a recommendation that no charges be filed. But Trump wouldn't let go. In Doral, Florida, on July 27th, Trump said he hoped Russian intelligence had successfully penetrated Hillary Clinton's network and stolen her emails, and urged Russia to release them as a way of getting to the bottom of it. "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing," Trump said during a news conference. "I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press." Now, as the Times reported, Trump was explicitly encouraging a foreign adversary to conduct cyber espionage against a former Secretary of State. He had openly urged Russia to interfere on his behalf in a presidential election. Soon, Russian support for Trump flooded in from all over. The Internet Research Agency, a Russian organization that, according to a Justice Department indictment, aims to interfere with elections and political processes, had started producing, purchasing, and posting pro-Trump ads on American social media. By July, it had hired more than 80 employees to put out ads to social media platforms such as YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Not everyone was in the dark. On July 30th, The Guardian reported on Trump's ties to Russia and Manafort's to pro-Putin forces in Ukraine, as they may have related to the changed Ukraine plank in the GOP platform. In addition to the DNC hack, Additional hacks against the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the Clinton campaign had been reported. The FBI is investigating, with all signs pointing to Russian involvement, The Guardian reported, adding that experts argue Vladimir Putin has attempted in the past to damage Western democracy, saying Russian security agencies have made cyber attacks on French, Greek, Italian, and Latvian targets during elections. On September 5th, The Washington Post published a story by Dana Priest, Ellen Nakashima, and Tom Hamburger reporting that U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies are investigating what they see as a broad, covert Russian operation in the United States to sow public distrust in the upcoming presidential election and in U.S. political institutions. The article added that the Russian campaign used cyber warfare to hack computers used in politics and to spread disinformation. At about the same time, Malcolm Nance published The Plot to Hack America, exposing how the Russians were using cyber spies and WikiLeaks to hack the DNC, the Clinton campaign, their friends and allies in the media, and voter registration systems in no fewer than 25 states. In October, the Financial Times presented evidence that Trump Soho had multiple ties to an international money laundering network. But the article, which was published behind a paywall, was not widely picked up, and with so much other reporting grabbing headlines, the issue of Trump's laundering money never dominated the national conversation. But these reports were the exceptions. The ongoing drip, drip, drip of thousands of emails being released throughout the campaign by Guccifer and WikiLeaks commandeered the news cycles far more than the revelations of the Russian intelligence operation. Meanwhile, contacts between Russia and the Trump campaign continued unabated, under cover of news instead of night. In August, Manafort met with longtime aide Konstantin Kilimnik at a Manhattan cigar bar, the Grand Havana Room, and talked about bills unpaid by their clients, about the overall situation in Ukraine, and about the current news, including the presidential campaign, according to a statement by Kilimnik. In Ukraine, political foes charged that Kilimnik might be working with Russian intelligence, but Kilimnik told the Washington Post that his meetings with Manafort were private visits and were in no way related to politics or the presidential campaign in the U.S. Yet suspicions were raised when a jet linked to Oleg Deripaska landed in New Jersey within hours of a meeting between Manafort and Kilimnik. A Deripaska spokeswoman told Vice News the billionaire was not offered and did not receive briefings from Manafort. In mid-August, Manafort resigned as campaign manager after it was revealed that he'd received secret payments from Ukraine. A few days later, however, on August 19th, one of Manafort's daughters, Andrea Manafort Shand, texted a friend that the resignation was merely for show. "So I got to the bottom of it," she wrote, in texts published by the Huffington Post. "As I suspected, my dad resigned from being the public face of the campaign, but is still very much involved behind the scenes. He felt he was becoming a distraction." As for the campaign staff, Trump's team merely shuffled the deck. The media spotlighted newcomers Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway, but Manafort continued to have influence. His deputy, Rick Gates, who had been with him in Ukraine, moved to the Republican National Committee, where he soon established himself as a player in Trump's circle. Delighting in the transgressions underlying the apparent chaos, Roger Stone broadcast his complicity, appearing by phone on the Alex Jones Show, hosted by the noted conspiracy theorist radio broadcaster in April, and predicting that devastating revelations would be forthcoming from WikiLeaks about the Clinton Foundation. On August 21st, Stone tweeted, "Trust me, it will soon be Podesta's time in the barrel." In August, Stone, in an appearance at the Southwest Broward Republican Organization in Florida, answered a question about what he suspected would be the campaign's October surprise by saying, "I actually have communicated with Julian Assange. I believe the next tranche of his documents pertain to the Clinton Foundation, but there's no telling what the October surprise may be. I expect Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks to drop a payload of new documents on Hillary on a weekly basis fairly soon," Stone said later in September on Boston Herald Radio. He added he was in touch with Assange through an intermediary. Stone was not the only Trump operative working with WikiLeaks. Representatives of the site coordinated points of attack directly with Donald Trump Jr. as well, with WikiLeaks emailing him on October 12th. "Hey Donald, great to see you and your dad talking about our publications." A couple of days earlier, Donald Trump had proclaimed, "I love WikiLeaks." "Strongly suggest your dad tweets this link if he mentions us," WikiLeaks wrote, directing Don Jr. to a link that suggested it would help Trump supporters sort through the stolen documents. "There's many great stories the press are missing, and we're sure some of your followers will find it," WikiLeaks went on. "BTW, we just released Podesta Emails Part 4. Don Jr. didn't respond to that message, but as the Wall Street Journal's Byron Tao pointed out, just 15 minutes later, the candidate himself tweeted, "Very little pickup by the dishonest media of incredible information provided by WikiLeaks. So dishonest. Rigged system." By this time, Donald Trump's ties to WikiLeaks and the Russian bots were fully operational and more than capable of coming to Trump's rescue when necessary. That became apparent on October 7th, when the Washington Post released the infamous video of Trump with Billy Bush, then host of the television show Access Hollywood, in which Trump says about women that you can just grab them by the pussy. Within an hour of the story's release, WikiLeaks was fighting to win back control of the narrative by releasing hacked emails from the account of Clinton campaign manager John Podesta. In addition, at least 2,752 Twitter accounts from Russia's Internet Research Agency went into action on Trump's behalf whenever they were necessary. On September 17th, Trump reversed his lies, asserting that Obama had been born in Kenya, and declared instead that Obama was born in the United States, period. Russian tweets came to the rescue, with various Russian accounts now asserting that it was Hillary who started the birther controversy. And so it went, Russian hackers and bots leading a supine press corps by its nose. After all, it is far easier to write stories about hacked emails that are delivered on a silver platter than to probe a multifarious political conspiracy to sabotage a presidential election. Thanks to Cambridge Analytica, Clinton's campaign may have faced an even bigger problem with Facebook than with Twitter bots. That's because the British data mining company had made a deal with a Russian-American academic named Alexander Kogan, who harvested no fewer than 50 million people's raw profiles from Facebook without their permission, roughly 30 million of which contained enough information to build psychographic profiles. The profiles had been assembled with the premise that big data enabled clients to drill into the psychology of individual voters, thereby allowing them to identify the different types of American voters and shape their behavior. It is difficult to assess the effectiveness of Cambridge Analytica's approach of micro-targeting narrowly tailored messages to the electorate. But according to The Intercept, Alexander Nix, the head of Cambridge Analytica, has claimed to have a massive database of 4,000 to 5,000 data points on every adult in America. Nix also claimed that Trump campaign online ads were seen at least 1.5 billion times. In the end, more than 126 million Facebook users were shown Russian-generated election propaganda. They were using 40 to 50,000 different variants of ads every day that were continuously measuring responses and then adapting and evolving based on that response, Martin Moore of King's College London told The Guardian. It's all done completely opaquely, and they can spend as much money as they like on particular locations because you can focus on a 5-mile radius or even a single demographic. Fake news is important, but it's only one part of it. These companies have found a way of transgressing 150 years of legislation that we've developed to make elections fair and open. Absurd as some fake news seemed, much of it went viral when it triggered Facebook algorithms that pushed the buttons of impassioned Trump supporters. A case in point, a story that became known as Pizzagate suggested that certain phrases in John Podesta's hacked emails were actually code words linked to a Democratic Party pedophilia ring based in the basement of a Washington, D.C. pizza parlor. Ludicrous as the story was, it went viral on sites such as Infowars.com, parts of Reddit, and various alt-right sites. The story, like others, had first started on Facebook, which shined a new light on a 2012 meeting Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg had with Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev in Moscow. They talked about Facebook's role in politics, and according to the Times, they joked about its importance in the American presidential campaign. Suddenly, the joke was on America, and though most Americans didn't yet realize it, it had deadly serious consequences. As he campaigned across the country, Trump occasionally addressed the issue of his ties to Russia. "I mean, I have nothing to do with Russia," he told CBS Miami on July 27, 2016. "I don't have any jobs in Russia. I'm all over the world, but we're not involved in Russia. I have nothing to do with Russia. Nothing to do. I never met Putin. I have nothing to do with Russia whatsoever." None of which placated Clinton. On September 26th, when she and Trump went head-to-head in the first presidential debate, Hillary attacked. "I was so shocked when Donald publicly invited Putin to hack into Americans. That is just unacceptable." Nonetheless, Trump's off-kilter response was enough for his supporters. "I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC," Trump said. "She's saying Russia, 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 but I don't... Maybe it was. I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay?" Finally, in the third debate on October 19th, about 3 weeks before the election, it came to a head, with Clinton asserting that Putin liked Trump because he'd rather have a puppet as president of the United States. Trump: "No puppet. No puppet." Clinton: "And it's pretty clear, Trump, you're the puppet." Clinton: "It's pretty clear you won't admit, Trump, no, you're the puppet." Clinton: "That the Russians have engaged in cyber attacks against the United States of America. That you encouraged espionage against our people. That you are willing to spout the Putin line, sign up for his wish list, break up NATO, do whatever he wants to do, and that you continue to get help from him, because he has a very clear favorite in this race. So I think that this is such an unprecedented situation. We've never had a foreign government trying to interfere in our election. We have 17 intelligence agencies, civilian and military, who have all concluded that these espionage attacks, these cyber attacks, come from the highest levels of the Kremlin, and they are designed to influence our election. I find that deeply disturbing." But the Russia issue got no traction and was buried by sensational but relatively insignificant reports of Trump's horrifying transgressions against women, Muslims, and immigrants, not to mention the never-ending reports about Clinton's emails. For the most part, political pundits thought Clinton was so far ahead that it didn't matter anyway. But on October 28th, 11 days before the election, then FBI Director James Comey announced in a letter to Congress that as a result of an unrelated case, the FBI had obtained additional emails that might relate to its investigation of Hillary's use of a private email server. It was soon revealed that the emails were obtained as the result of an investigation into former Congressman Anthony Weiner. Suddenly, the Hillary Clinton email case and conversation had been reopened. In the end, after reviewing the new emails, Comey said the FBI had not changed its conclusions. But so far as the general public knew, Hillary was the only candidate being investigated. On October 27th, polls were showing her with a reasonably comfortable margin of 6 to 9 points over Trump. But Clinton later said, "Our analysis is that Comey's letter, raising doubts that were groundless, baseless, proven to be, stopped our momentum." To complicate matters further, on October 31st, just 9 days before the election, a New York Times headline, "Investigating Donald Trump, FBI sees no clear link to Russia," seemed to exculpate Trump entirely, when in fact the investigations were just beginning. But the electorate didn't know that. Voters only knew that Hillary was being hammered in the press, and Donald Trump always seemed to skate free. The polls tightened. By November 3rd, that 7% margin had closed to less than 3%. In the closing week before the election, Trump used Russia-backed WikiLeaks as a battering ram against Hillary day after day. On October 31st, in Warren, Michigan, Trump told a rally, "Did you see where on WikiLeaks it was announced that they were paying protesters to be violent $1,500? Did you see another one? Another one came in today? This WikiLeaks is like a treasure trove." Then on November 2nd in Orlando, "Out today, WikiLeaks just came out with a new one, just a little while ago. It's just been shown that a rigged system with more collusion, possibly illegal, between the Department of Justice, the Clinton campaign, and the State Department." And on November 4th, in Wilmington, Ohio, "Boy, I love reading those WikiLeaks." On November 5th, 3 days before the presidential election, Ivanka and Jared Kushner made a pilgrimage to the grave of the Chabad Rebbe Menachem Mendel Schneerson in the old Montefiore Cemetery in Queens, New York. Known as the Ohel, the Rebbe's grave is considered holy by followers of Chabad and is visited by tens of thousands of people annually. Jared and Ivanka reportedly made a special prayer for Ivanka's father there, at the grave of a man whose adherents believed he had not really died, that he was the Messiah, a man who had been the leader of a movement that somehow led directly to Vladimir Putin. On November 8th, Election Day, Russian hackers targeted election systems in at least 21 states, mostly in the form of assaults on the vast back-end election apparatus, voter registration operations, state and local election databases, e-poll books, and other equipment. Initially, the impact of these attacks was unclear. Typical of the complaints, according to an election monitoring group called Election Protection, in a Democratic-leaning county in a swing state, dozens of voters in Durham, North Carolina, were being told they were ineligible to vote, even when they displayed valid registration cards. Others were sent from one polling station to another, only to be rejected again, or were told incorrectly they had already voted. Months earlier, VR systems, which provided information about voting via e-books for Durham, had been hacked by Russians. Without VR's information, which is used to verify voters' eligibility, voters would be unable to cast ballots at all. Still, all over America, the consensus was that Hillary would win. According to Nate Silver's 538 election site, 9 of the top 10 pollsters had Hillary winning. Silver gave Trump a 28.6% chance of winning, but that was far more generous than most of his colleagues. Others gave Trump less than a 1% shot. Trump impressed friends as being relaxed and at ease with what he characterized as a no-lose situation. He was like, "Look, what do I have to lose?" Pastor Daryl Scott, CEO of the National Diversity Coalition for Trump, told GQ. I'm gambling with house money. You know what I mean? If I win, great. I want to win. If I lose, what's my default position? The CEO of Trump International. Even WikiLeaks was making plans for President Hillary Clinton. At 6:35 p.m., WikiLeaks wrote to Don Jr. Hi, Don. If your father loses, we think it is much more interesting if he does